Welcome to Cynicism.
This week on Cynicism, we have a costume drama double feature with, first up, Emma.
Emma, they're here!
With who?
And then, we didn't start the fire, but this portrait of a lady did, with Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
What's up, Brian?
What's up, Nick? We're here with our 18th episode of Cynicism.
Live from my apartment in
this
Buffalo,
is round,
New York.
Round two at your apartment, because they're still doing loud things at my house.
Yeah, and how you been, man?
I've been okay.
Yeah.
You know, with everyone freaking out about the coronavirus, taking it seriously. Washing my hands more frequently than I usually do.
Yeah, it's a weird time right now. It's a weird, scary time in America.
Like, like when I hear someone coughing in a theater now, it's more so I'm like, you should absolutely go home.
Leave those seat gaps. Don't be afraid to leave a gap.
Yep. And don't be afraid to stream the movie from home.
Yeah. If you're not feeling good, watch something on Netflix. Don't go out. Yeah, but I mean, I've been hanging in. You've been hanging in. Coronavirus is happening.
It's been hanging in.
It doesn't seem to be going anywhere. Primaries are weird, but we won't get into that.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that right now.
But what we do want to talk about is just what's going on in the world of movies, because that's what we are. We're a movie podcast.
Yes, we are.
And the coronavirus, we talked a little bit about it last week. But it's still having huge implications for the film industry, because the cancellations for films continues to go on. There were two films pushed back just this week. Both kids movies, I guess maybe that's a fair shout. You know, you don't want to put families in danger.
Yeah, you don't want to be bringing your kids to a theater with a bunch of other kids who may potentially also be sick.
Yeah, and that was the My Spy movie was pushed back, starring Batista, and the Peter Rabbit movie, which I don't think that's a great loss for anybody. I could solidly give no fucks about that. But I mean, one of the things is it's indicative of what might continue to happen, because, you know, we talked a little bit about the James Bond pushback last week. We talked about how there's probably a lot of movies on the bubble right now, too, because of what it is essentially is you have a lot of these big studio franchises, and when they launch one of these movies, they tend to go for a global release. And if theaters simply aren't open in countries like China and countries like Italy right now because of the outbreak, you know, that's definitely a lot of revenue they're missing out on, and a huge chunk of the audience that they rely on for these kind of behemoth mega blockbusters. There's been some rumors about Mulan being pushed back. Very disheartening for me, because for some reason Vin Diesel's huge in Asia. They might be pushing back the Fast and Furious 9 film, so don't want to see, but you know, we have to do things to keep people safe. But I mean, outside of that, the other big story right now is the kind of impact it's having on film festivals. Recently Cannes went ahead and announced that at this time they're still planning on going ahead with the festival, but they did kind of add the caveat that they're constantly monitoring things. They're in touch with the World Health Organization.
Right. You would hope that they would do the smart thing if things continue to get worse.
Yeah.
That they would just say, all right, guys, you know, we understand the importance of this festival, but we also understand the importance of people's livelihoods. We
right.
Keep them
right.
safe.
I think probably one of the scarier things here, at least not from necessarily the safety perspective, but from the industry perspective, is that for something like Cannes, if worst case scenario they do have to cancel, that is a festival that's partially subsidized by the French government, so they'll mostly be all right. There's no insurance on it, but the government subsidizes that festival. On the other hand, though, you do have something like South by Southwest, which recently was canceled, and that's obviously not subsidized. And right. What that means is they did not have insurance on that festival. And what we're seeing is that might be completely cataclysmic for that festival. There was talk of possibly delaying it, but now it doesn't look like that's going to be a possibility. It also doesn't look like they're going to be able to recoup their losses, and there's a very good chance South by Southwest as a festival might be dead.
So. And that's insane, because like that festival's been going on for so long at this point. It does seem like this is a very likely outcome from something like this.
Yeah, it does. It seems like with going forward, I think people are going to have to be very cautious, and maybe especially organizers in the industry are really going to have to look at kind of the financial risks as well that you're taking to put these things on if it's going to be viable. You know, right now we have no real timeline on what the virus is going to be like, and me and you certainly here, we're not experts on anything.
Yeah, if you hear us misquote something or misinterpret something, obviously are just saying what we're hearing. It's a lot of hearsay.
So. Right. But certainly I would say don't right now plan for your event probably not happening. Is the safe bet. And then, worst case scenario, you were overcautious.
Right.
That's better to be than ending up risking both other people's safety and your own financial investment. It's not just the festivals. You were seeing some news that looks a little bit brighter, in China.
A little bit of positive news. So it's just like some murmurs coming out. There, I read an article today stating that the China Film Group, as well as PRC, which is in charge of like the theaters and like the production companies and such in China, are looking at reopening their Beijing office as early as next week, which means they could be starting to like bring theaters back open as early as April, even like probably around May, which is just in time for that Black Widow release.
Disney's got to make sure they get that Marvel money.
But like I said, it's just some murmurs. Like this, it's potentially like could be as late as July before anything happens in China. But the fact that they're even talking about it means that there's been enough information for them to say things are getting better. Like we've taken some appropriate steps to move beyond this virus.
Yeah, it seems like at least from what I've been seeing, at least in China, temporarily, it looks like the escalation of the virus is starting to stagnate somewhat. Which again, we have no idea if that's because we're not experts. We don't know if that's a temporary thing or if it's good news. But right now, it appears like it might be good news.
Yeah.
It's definitely good news. If it happens as according to plan, it's good news for both China and for their film industry.
Yeah, keep your eyes on countries like China and Italy and places like that to see like what's happening there and like what do their communities look like? How have they been handling it? Just to kind of give you a timeline of what to expect here.
Yeah, because obviously it is so fresh here. You know, we really don't know what it's going to look like over the next couple of months here in the States. But we're definitely going to, at least from the film perspective, keep you up to date on things in that department. But I do want to, just before we close out the film news section of this podcast, I did want to quickly just send a shout out and just pay homage. This week we did lose Max von Sydow, which he's very famous. If you're familiar with Ingmar Bergman's films, he did star in The Seventh Seal and Wild Strawberries, a lot of Ingmar Bergman's early films. If you don't even know Ingmar Bergman's films, you're probably at the very least familiar kind of with the iconic image of a knight playing chess against death on a beach. That's the famous image from The Seventh Seal, and Max von Sydow was that knight. But beyond that, probably what American audiences know him best as is, as was Father Marin in The Exorcist.
See, this is where I'm the most familiar with him.
Yeah. And, I mean, you know, obviously one of, if not the most iconic horror film of all time. And obviously an iconic role, an incredible film. And yeah, it's, I mean, he was 90, so he definitely lived a large, full life. But we're going to move on from movie news and get into contemporary movies with our review coming up of Emma.
You think I ought to review them? I lay it down as a general rule, Harriet, that if a woman doubts whether she should accept a man or not, she certainly ought to refuse him.
Perhaps it is safer. Do you think I had better say no?
Not for the world would I advise you either way. You must be the best judge of your own happiness.
I have now quite determined and really almost made up my mind to refuse Mr. Martin.
Nick, what can we say about Autumn de Wilde's Emma period? Do you think the period was on purpose?
Is there a period in the title?
There is a period at the end of Emma. And none of the other versions of Emma are Emma period.
Maybe it's because it's a period piece.
Probably. I think that was what I was trying to get at. This is the Emma period piece review. Autumn de Wilde is a... This is her first movie, yeah?
Yeah, I believe so. She's primarily done up until now sort of music videos, photography.
Yeah.
For a lot of indie bands.
Yeah, I mean, some singer-songwriters, especially Elliot Smith, being like a personal friend of hers from back in the day. I have the coffee table book from where she just like basically did a whole biography about like her friendship with him, and it includes a lot of really personal photos. It's really amazing.
Pretty much all the Jenny Lewis stuff too, in terms of her music videos and the Rattle Kylie stuff, and pretty much trace that all back. But this is her first movie. It is, as we said, a period piece. It's an adaptation of Jane Austen's Emma.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the first adaptation of Emma.
No, I think Gwyneth Paltrow is in one of the older ones.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of them. One of the probably most famous adaptations, but the loosest adaptation, and probably my favorite, is Clueless.
You know what? You're right.
Yeah. It was part of that whole like 90s trend of just randomly remaking old classic novels as teen movies, and probably one of the best. But this is a new adaptation, and it does star Anya Taylor-Joy, who's one of my favorite actresses working. I absolutely love her. You might have seen her in films like The Witch.
This feels like it's probably like what happened to Thomasin
when she became full witch.
When she became full witch, she got to become Emma and just delight in the delicacies and like butter.
So going into this movie, were you looking forward to it, Brian?
Yeah, actually, I was. Like seeing the trailer for this was quite fun. Very very vivid colors. Like everyone's outfits were gorgeous. I enjoyed like the dry wit that they kind of showcased in the trailer, so I was excited to see this, not really realizing about the other versions of the movie that already existed.
Yeah. So I would say I went into pretty cautiously optimistic about it. I wasn't that familiar with Autumn de Wilde's work going into it. I'd seen a few of the music videos, but probably didn't even realize they were her up until looking into this closer to the release. I am a huge fan, though, of Anya Taylor-Joy, as I mentioned, so I've pretty much seen, I think, anything she's been in since The Witch. And it does have a pretty great stacked cast with actors like Bill Nye in here. Mm-hmm. Johnny Flynn's a pretty good actor. I've seen him on shows like Lovesick. And it did, as you said, the trailer did seem to showcase this kind of like dry sense of humor. So I was pretty stoked going into it. I think for me, actually seeing it, I think I would say it's all right.
I'm going to say that I was underwhelmed by this movie as far as like how the story kind of was delivered. But the things that I want to talk about really in the beginning is like how this film looks. Like,
yeah.
It is vibrant. It is gorgeous. Like, it looks wonderful. I think the set designs and like the way the food, the way the outfits, the way the hair, everybody, the way everybody's styled is very fun to look at.
Yeah.
It does degrade throughout the film as it goes on because it just kind of goes, well, you know, it's basically just the same thing over and over and over again.
It's a visually immaculate film. Like, it is incredible to look at. In terms of the production design here, everything looks magnificent. It very much recalls a lot of late period Wes Anderson, in terms of everything looking very vibrant and colorful. There's almost even kind of like a slightly kitsch element to it that recalled for me the Grand Budapest Hotel at times. Especially you mentioned like the food. That was another thing where it definitely came into mind, you know, like the Mendel's cakes and Grand Budapest. That kind of food that you know is real but almost looks so sort of insanely like over-exorbitant that it becomes almost like play food.
Yeah, it almost when you mention it looks kind of like play food, this very much felt like somebody like put the dialogue in here as very much like, hey, we're trying to do this dialogue as seriously as we can, but it felt like it didn't feel right. It felt like a group of people who weren't really matched up for this style of film. I don't know, like hearing people deliver certain lines just kind of felt really odd to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was just because if it was like an overacting thing or if it was just that everybody just seemed so pompous.
Well, I think that's kind of the point.
Well, I mean, I know everybody is supposed to be pompous, but man, they fucking suck. Like,
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, for me, I'll start by saying I think for me, I mostly like this movie. Before we go into any issues we have with it, I want to just highlight a few more things that I really do like about it, just in terms of the production, because of obviously you mentioned, you know, how the film looks too, but I also really love how the film sounds in terms of like there's great sort of, you know, when you have these movies, it's often a lot of just like strings.
This is a very like whimsical kind of playful sound.
Yeah, there's almost like kind of a folk thing going on where there's lots of a cappella music at times, there's instrumental folk guitar at other times. It kind of makes sense given who's making this movie, that it's kind of probably influenced somewhat from the artists that she worked with in her career.
Yeah, I would say like I don't know if I got a folk kind of thing as much as I got like a chamber kind of sound to it,
like a Baroque pop type
thing. Like it's felt more like that with just like really plucky instrumentation things. Yeah, like that, like that's where I kind of
and I would say when it comes to the performances, for me, I mostly think everybody here is pretty good. I think Anya Taylor-Joy I really love in this movie. I think what she does with the character of Emma is, I feel like often in other adaptations of Emma, I've seen at least the two adaptations I've seen previously, they make her more of an empathetic character. And here she's almost like icy. Like,
yeah, she's very unlikable.
Yes. And it is kind of, it's, I mean, for me, what again, I really like about the movie is that, and I can't say for certain how much of this comes from the source material because I don't claim to be a Jane Austen expert, but I do like that it's pretty much like a movie about privilege and her having to come to terms over the course of the film with kind of the privilege she has in this society.
I will say that the weight and like the consequences of this movie are very minor, very small.
Yeah, yeah. Traditionally, I feel like in Jane Austen or kind of costume dramas, it does tend to be more breezy. But I do like, because of these movies do tend to be so breezy, a lot of times it does feel so slight that the only consequences here are sort of romance, but there are sort of characters here who genuinely do get hurt and whose social standing, because of they're not part of the upper echelon, they might be truly damaged by the consequences of people being careless with their emotions and the reactions.
Right.
And that's another performance I really wanted to highlight.
You're talking about Miranda Hart.
Miranda Hart
as Ms.
Bates.
Fucking
rules.
She is hilarious. She's so funny, but at the same time, like, you kind of do get like these little annoying things from her, but she's doing it so well that you can't hate her.
It's this perfect kind of in between where she hits this mark of being super endearing and total, and you understand also why she would be completely annoying.
Yeah.
And also when the film calls for her to be empathetic, again, she delivers. I know Miranda Hart mainly. She's actually famous in the UK as a big stand-up comedian. She also has a sitcom called Miranda that's on the BBC that's very popular. But I've never seen her in something that kind of requires this range. And I think she steals pretty much every scene she's in. I just laughed pretty much every time she was on screen. And I do as well really like Bill Nye in this movie too.
Yeah, he has a very limited, like, he has very limited screen time because of the character that he's playing, I feel like, because he is kind of a shut-in.
Yeah, and that was one of my disappointments, I guess, with the performances. He's so good, I almost just wanted to see more of him.
Right.
And maybe this story doesn't need him as that essential a character, but he is so good when he's on screen.
Right, there's definitely a lot of funny moments next to a fireplace with him.
Yeah.
And just like him going out, whenever he goes out, like his just constant neuroses of just being outside and like being around people. I guess he's just afraid of dying.
Yeah. I think where I have an issue with it, and maybe this speaks to maybe what you're picking up on as well, or kind of talking about with something just feeling a bit off here.
Yeah.
Is that for me, what the issue is I feel like this movie is doing a lot of things really well, but it doesn't know what it necessarily wants to be from scene to scene.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause tonally it feels off. Like, if you take the very early parts of this film, there is, as I mentioned, like, this complete kind of emotional detachment to it. It almost feels at times like something closer to The Favorite, where it's sort of ironically looking at this period. And then by the end, it's become so sort of earnest that it's kind of almost just a straight BBC style adaptation of a period drama. You know, it doesn't feel that far removed from something like the Keira Knightley Pride and Prejudice. And the fact that there's not this consistency in tone means you kind of don't know when a scene is being played straight for laughs or if it's actually meant to have gravitas.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like there is much of a shift really from like, especially when a character is learning a lesson.
Yeah, I think me and you are probably thinking of the same scene here where, without spoiling anything, but there's a very crucial scene revolving around a picnic in this movie. And the way the movie had been built tonally at that point, I reacted to that scene with complete laughter and was really, like, laughing hard.
Yeah.
And then suddenly,
it was awkward.
Yes, because of it, you realize that was not what the film was going for. And I don't think the film was intentionally trying to surprise you. I think it was a misdirection of tone.
Right, like things should have been building up to that point, and it didn't feel like it was building up that way.
Yeah, it does feel very much like it switched gears when it wanted to, rather than sort of organically getting where they wanted to by the end of the film. I think for me, I think the thing is, I still found the individual moments, both in the very latter part of the film or in the very early part of the film, to work kind of on their own individually enough that I could kind of overlook that. But, you know, I can also see probably exactly what you mean. If that's something that it's bothering you throughout the film, it's kind of hard to take a scene on an individual basis if this is like, if you're trying to connect with it emotionally scene to scene. Mm-hmm. That can be a real hurdle. I think there's a lot I do like about this film. I don't think it's a perfect film. I think this is a very mild recommendation for me.
I say it's an interesting watch at the very least. It's a very good like debut feature film from somebody who hasn't done a period piece before, let alone a full length movie. I think it's very well done as far as like the cinematography is concerned. I think everything looks wonderful. I think the soundtrack is wonderful. I really like a lot of the acting. I just think it's the story that really like kind of falls flat for me, or just like doesn't have as much importance as I would like to see in a film. I think I would prefer to see people going on a real journey as opposed to like a minor inconvenience.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's definitely, I think, like a personal.
Yeah, it's
preference.
Definitely a personal thing for me.
I think that's probably also one thing that even for me is kind of holding me back from liking it as much as I know some of my friends have, in that at the end of this day, for as many sort of creative flourishes that the movie is taking, it is in a lot of ways still just a very traditional Jane Austen costume drama period piece. And if that's what you love, if you're the type who like turns on the BBC Masterpiece Theater PBS stuff and absolutely loves that, you're probably gonna have a really great time watching that. For me, I think the aesthetic choices here definitely involved me more than they would have any other otherwise. But aside from that, it's really just the performances by Anya Taylor-Joy and Miranda Hart that really anchored this for me, because I think they're both outstanding in this. And I will say, too, I do think, again, a lot of those early individual moments of comedy worked for me. I'm really excited to see Anya Taylor-Joy now in the upcoming Edgar Wright movie later this year, Last Night in Soho, because I've never seen her do comedy before.
Yeah, and I think she'll do very well with a script like that.
But I think this is, it's a mild recommendation for me. As you said, it's a good debut, but it's not anything special.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's really reinventing from a screenwriting standpoint, but it is visually fantastic. So
yeah. So I think that's it for us on Emma, but we're gonna talk about a few other movies that you can find out right now, either recently released in theaters or home on video on demand. Alright, Brian, so we're going to talk about a few movies that just recently came out.
Yes, welcome to the middle part of the podcast, where we talk about films that we either saw on streaming or in theaters, but not with each other.
No, a solo joints.
Solo joints.
And I think you saw one on VOD, right?
Don't you dare introduce me. Yeah, I actually saw one on streaming recently. As I see many ads for movies on Instagram, one that came up recently was for a movie called Swallow. It is a beautiful, almost like horror film, I would say, like kind of suspenseful in a way too, following the life of a woman who feels it necessary to please the people in her life. So much so that she becomes unhappy with her surroundings, even though she doesn't really want for much of anything. But she does want one thing, and that's control, which she doesn't seem to have. So one of the ways she is coping with this is through swallowing things that she finds around the house. The first thing that she finds in the house is a marble. So she swallows this marble, and then it passes through her body, and she And when it passes through her, like the fact that she was able to just like have that go in her and have it come out of her and her be like, all right, I did that. And like, there's even like this moment where she's kind of acting a little cute about it. She's like really excited and like kind of wiggling in the bed. And her husband's like, what are you smiling about? And she's like, I did something unexpected, but she doesn't tell him what she did.
Yeah.
but her family eventually comes to find out what she's doing, and then more drama ensues from there. It is a visually striking movie. Just wonderful color palettes, wonderful use of light. Like, just there's light and shadow everywhere, reflections all over the damn place. Like, you see reflections of this character in countertops, in marbles, in windows and mirrors. It's constantly used. There's some wonderful scenes where they put up like almost light filters on the windows so that this room has like a red light, a blue light, and then it has like this kind of goldish hue, and she's just kind of like, I did something fun with the windows, and the husband's just kind of like, yeah, whatever. So like, you kind of see how like when she does stuff she feels underappreciated, but like as things become more out of her control throughout the movie, she starts becoming more aggressive with the things that she begins to swallow, and it can be hard to watch. Oof. And there's times where she even feels like she's not sure if she's going to do it or not, and it kind of ramps up pretty quick.
Is there like a decent amount of like body horror to this?
I'm going to say there is a little bit of blood.
Okay.
I'm not going to, it doesn't get too grotesque, but man, if you've ever gagged on a piece of food, there's like a scene where it just feels painful.
Okay.
And it's very painful to watch certain things. But yeah, I really enjoyed what the film was going for as far as like just kind of like a story of a woman like regaining her control in her life. I will say that the lead actress is wonderful. I actually really enjoyed watching her transformation throughout the movie. There are some actors in the movie that aren't so great, which kind of like pulls me out of some of the moments. Like they have their moments in the movie where they do okay. But I would say like overall the acting is probably like the least consistent thing, but the visuals are incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And, the story is also, powerful and impactful in a way that you don't typically see in a lot of things. It's very simple, but it's also just, it's going to resonate with a lot of people, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like an unusual pick. Not the most standard story in the world.
Definitely not the most standard. The cinematographer for this film is Caitlin Arizmendi, whose film preceding this was Cam, which is about a cam girl.
Huge fan of that movie.
Yeah, so like I haven't seen that movie, but I do know people were big fans of that
and
thought that was really great. There was also a film that she was a part of at Sundance this year called Charm City Kings, which is about the group of young men that ride dirt bikes and motorcycles around Baltimore. And a friend of mine said that that was an incredible movie. It was one of her favorites. So
cool. Well, now you definitely have my interest on that. I'm going to have to check that out. I saw a movie too recently. This is one that is out in theatrical release now. And it's called The Way Back. This is a new sports drama in quotation marks, I guess, because the sports aren't really the key part of this film, but it's essentially the story of a man who's kind of a construction worker and was a kind of star basketball player on his old team, and he gets kind of called in because of the team is failing to coach this team while struggling with his own issues with alcoholism. The film's directed by Gavin O'Connor, who I'm a big fan of his movies. He's previously made the film Miracle, which was sort of about the miracle on ice at the Olympics back in the 80s. And then even more kind of striking to me, he made the movie Warriors that starred Joel Edgerton and Tom Hardy, which I think is probably just one of the best sports dramas I've ever seen. And what I really like about the movies that Kevin O'Connor makes is they seem to be a type of movie that doesn't exist really anymore. We have sometimes occasionally like adult drama films, but they don't really make films anymore about like working class people so much. All of his films tend to be about very like blue collar working class people, and the visuals you see in the movies tend to be in like very dilapidated sort of neighborhoods, poor low-income neighborhoods, and it's kind of refreshing to see sort of movies that take part in that world and actually have a care and a knowing of those types of characters. Ben Affleck stars in this movie, and a lot of the issues with alcoholism in the film kind of stem from his own issues in his real life. I listened to an interview kind of where they talked to the director, Kevin O'Connor, you know, about really having to sort of shepherd Ben Affleck through the process of kind of recovering from alcoholism, and how much of the film's stories are inspired from his own stories. And at times it's really hard to watch because of they don't really provide any easy outs in the film. There's so many moments sort of frustration as an audience member watching, you know, sort of the relapse happen and understanding where it's coming from, but knowing how detrimental it's going to be. I think Ben Affleck is terrific in the film. I think one interesting thing about Ben Affleck as an actor is that there is something about his career where he is very self-aware kind of who he is. And sometimes it almost feels like he's trying to communicate that to a larger audience with the roles he plays. You know, I even think about something like Gone Girl, to me is a lot almost about Ben Affleck kind of playing against his public image and the media attention he receives. But I think in this movie, it's a nice mixture of being able to see him be honest about his own issues, but also kind of return to that sort of blue-collar Boston-type role that he kind of made his name with in stuff like Good Will Hunting. I think if I do have an issue with it, there's moments where the dialogue's a little bit flatter than I'd like it to be. And there's some decisions, I think, in maybe the final third of the movie that feel a little bit rushed to me. But at the same time, I found it really powerful, and I think there's some really good performances. Also, Al Madrigal from The Daily Show is in this, and in like a small, or not even that small, a kind of supporting role, and is surprisingly good in what's not a comedic role at all. It's a completely dramatic role. I kind of also probably would have liked to know a little bit more about the people on this basketball team, the kids. But as I said, this movie's not really a sports drama, even if it pretends to be one.
Yeah, the trailer definitely puts the kids like a little bit up there as being something. But
yeah, I mean, there's kind of a bit of a relationship with one, but they're a little bit more secondary. They're more a pressure for him to have more responsibility in his life than anything.
So this isn't the Bad News Bears.
This is not Bad News Bears. No, it's not the original Bad News Bears or the weird remake they made with Billy Bob Thornton, which I believe Richard Linklater did. Not sure why, but hey, you have fun, man. But yeah, so way back, that's a big recommendation for me. I really like this movie. If you're looking for really good sort of character drama, I highly recommend it.
Awesome. Yeah, so that's going to wrap it up for this middle section. We're going to come back next with some real fire with Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Thank you.
Welcome back
to the normal review portion of the show.
We're going to talk about Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Yeah.
Can you say it in French? Because this movie is in French.
I absolutely cannot, but I can give it a try.
I'll tell you that when we got to the theater to watch this movie, the staff was like, "Do you know that this is a French film with English subtitles?" And I was like, "Yes.
We do.
We absolutely do." But some people didn't know that.
And apparently they were very angry.
It's like, how dare you have a movie with an English title and it's a French film? What the hell?
How dare you make a French film that's in French?
Yeah, what's going on?
What are the odds?
There's more than one language, and it just happens to be French is another language.
I'm an American, damn it. Dub it. No, but this is Portrait of a Lady on Fire. It's the much acclaimed film from Celine Sciamma. It did win Best Screenplay, and I believe it was the runner-up at the Cannes Film Festival last
year. Fuck you, Roman Polanski, for the award show that you were in that beat out this movie.
That's a different award show.
I know, but I don't care.
Okay.
Just fuck you, Roman Polanski.
That's fair. Do you know what did beat it out at Cannes Film Festival?
What?
A little movie called Parasite.
Ooh.
So
fuck you, Bong Joon-ho.
No, but yeah, let's get into that though, because I did want to mention that what Brian's referring to is there was recently basically the French version of the Oscars, and it's become a big story kind of in the entertainment press, because when the award for Best Director came up, it was given to famous pedophile Roman Polanski. And
gross.
Adele Hanel, to her credit, stormed out the moment it happened. Cameras caught her doing it. And then when they caught her in the hallway after, she very loudly did an ironic clap and was like, "Cheers for the pedophile. Cheers for the pedophile. Let's give more to the pedophiles." Which, kudos Adele Hanel. You rule. That's awesome. I'm glad for somebody standing up and taking a stand and not taking bullshit.
Adele Hanel did that?
Yeah.
Oh, not the director?
No, Celine Sciamma, I think she did escort Adele Hanel out, but Adele Hanel was much, much furious.
Fuck yeah.
So, definitely kudos to her. We love that. Appreciate that attitude, especially in 2020 when we're not supposed to be taking that shit. But
we're never supposed to be taking that shit. It's just getting better now.
Another thing I did want to mention, because we did just mention Parasite, and this film did premiere at the Cannes Film Festival alongside Parasite. Definitely arrived on a lot of hype. And prior to its American release here, which happened on Valentine's Day, it was released by the same distributor as Parasite, Neon. And famously, after Bong Joon-ho won Best Picture and Best Director, he kind of made a speech, and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't remember word for word, because also I obviously don't speak Korean. But he did get on the stage and asked Celine Sciamma to come up with him and said that "I wish I could give one of these to you because you deserve it every bit as much as I do." Which again just reinforces that Bong Joon-ho is the greatest person, and also is another reason to be excited about this movie, because if Bong Joon-ho loves it, we probably should be excited about it too.
But even if he didn't, you should also be excited about
yes.
it.
On behalf, before we get into this movie too much, I think there's slight spoilers here, because not in terms of the actual movie, but in terms of what I think of it, because you might remember it was on our Best of the Year episode. I did put it as one of my honorable mentions.
Yep.
So you might think, I like this movie a little bit.
And I hadn't had a chance to see it until more recently.
Yeah.
But if I had seen it last year, I probably would have put it on my best of then too.
Yeah. So I think it's safe to say you know what I think of the movie, at least a little bit. I'm curious, Brian, you went into this fresh. You knew a little bit of anticipating it.
Yeah.
What was your reaction like?
Well, it's like, before going to the movie, I had some people go like, well, what's it about? And I said, I think it's a love story. And that's about all I know.
Yeah.
I know that somebody is painting somebody else, and it's a love story. But I don't know much more than that. And, you know, like, to put it in very simple terms, that's what it is.
That's what it's about.
It's what it's about. That is the like very basic premise. There is a painter who has been like what is the word?
Kind of like tasked or commissioned.
Commissioned to do a portrait of this woman who is being given away to a man for marriage, and she refuses to like sit down with other painters. Like, it's been increasingly difficult to get her to be painted. When you realize why she's not sitting, the movie kind of like explains why she's not sitting down, mm-hmm. and giving the attention to those painters, because it's just another one of those things about like not having control over your own life. But
she's sort of tasked with painting her in secret.
Yeah, she can't exactly tell this woman that she's painting her, so all that she knows is that they're walking together so that this woman doesn't commit suicide,
yeah.
like her sister did, which is the whole reason why everyone is in this one place at that same time. It is... Honestly, this movie hurts. It's very sad.
Yeah, it's sad, but it's really, really beautiful.
It's you know, it's one of those, like, I would say, like, it's a star-crossed lovers kind of, like, storyline in a sense. Like, you know it can't end the way you want it to,
mm-hmm.
like, from the very get-go, just because of the times that it was, like, placed in. But, man, I loved it so much. I loved the chemistry between the two actresses that were playing the lead roles. I even love the actress that plays the housekeeper. Like,
oh, she's terrific.
So she's so yeah. wonderful. It's like the movie kind of centers around the other two, but like a lot of times it's the three of them.
Yeah, there's like, kind of almost like, obviously the Marianne and Heloise characters kind of form this romantic relationship. But then there's the housekeeper, and there's times where it does almost feel like this big family,
mm-hmm.
like just, or maybe even just like this tight little group of sisters who have found kind of a home together when they're just left to themselves.
Yeah.
And it's really beautiful to kind of see, especially given the time period, sort of the relationships and just the home they're able to make when not having to deal with the societal pressures of that time period, and kind of just be themselves.
Yeah, just forgetting what is required of them, in air quotes, because when you're supposed to act one certain way, you do definitely feel unfulfilled and you're kind of trapped. And the places that they're in, although beautiful and like they need for nothing, is very much like a prison.
Yeah, it's there is a kind of form of claustrophobia to it. I did see a really kind of funny tweet the other day that was like, Portrait of a Lady on Fire is a story of what happens when women are left alone on an island together, and The Lighthouse is a story of what happens when men are left alone on an island together. And I thought that was really good. But like, you know, you mentioned here the beauty of the landscape, though. I do have to mention, too, one thing I really love about this film is the cinematography in this movie is absolutely ridiculous.
It's top-notch.
I think it easily should have, again, if there was more consideration put forth towards foreign films. I think this is one that should have easily gotten a cinematography nomination at the Oscars last year. I do believe the cinematographer picked that up as well at Cannes Film Festival last year. It's just like, what's wonderful about the movie is that, you know, you have a protagonist in this who is a painter, and it's almost like the color palette and the hues that they use for the natural landscapes, for the dresses they wear, they almost have this kind of quality to it in the coloration of looking kind of like the strokes of a painter. You know, the blues are kind of this like light pale blue. The greens are so bold and rich.
What I found interesting about like the wardrobe in particular is like each character is wearing the same outfit through across multiple days.
Yes.
It also shows like the labor behind putting on some of those outfits, because it, a lot of times they're taking on and putting on the outfits that they're wearing over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Be it to like she puts an art smock over herself, or she is trying on a dress specifically for the painting. It required two people to put on the outfit.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, this is a lot more than anybody else has ever had to do for wardrobe, but it was definitely true to that time.
Yeah. And what I think too is, you know, the two protagonists, obviously here, we talked about the housekeeper, but both of these actresses, both Adèle Haenel and, I'm going to butcher it because it's in French, but I believe...
Naomi?
Merlin? Haenel. Oh, okay.
Was it Haenel? It's not Haenel.
No, that's Adèle Haenel.
It was Merlin.
Merlin. Yeah. But the two of them are absolutely outstanding.
Oh my gosh, just wonderful performances.
Because what's so great about this film is because of the way the plot device essentially of the Marianne character having to kind of paint in secret is it kind of uses the device to show how she falls in love with throughout the film with her. Because what you're seeing is not just her studying the other girl to be able to sort of pick up on things for her painting, but she's noticing sort of all these little tics that make her who she is. You know, the more she sort of studies Heloise, the more she notices like the way she smiles at certain things,
way she doesn't smile very often.
Yeah, or you know, little tics she'll have when she's nervous or trying to hide something. It's that kind of thing that is foundational to kind of a relationship and love. Those things that you know so intimately about your partner because of you've known them so long.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those things that grow to become the things that you love so much about them because they're so endearing. They make them an individual and something you only know about that person.
And what's very exciting about the way they do this is it's not actually a long period of time.
No.
That this movie, it probably takes place over a few weeks.
Yeah, yep.
And, but like as you're there, they spend so much time with each other that it is very hot and heavy. Like they are very close to each other. They are studying each other in a way that like you can only do if you're in that close of a quarters with somebody else.
Yeah, there's a real intimacy to the film. I mean, this also is a very sexy film. Like the way the two characters sort of study each other, the sexual tension and romantic tension between the two. It's insane. It's riveting. There's great,
for lack of better words, is on fire, man. It is very hot.
And I mean, there's great scenes where they're just, you know, sort of, working together, maybe on an artistic project, maybe drawing, maybe talking to each other. And this is where it gets back to the performances, 'cause you can see so much of what is communicated between the characters in just glances. The way they look at each other, the way, you know, they withhold a smile or kind of momentarily react to something that only we as an audience see, but the other character might miss in each other. It's something that communicates so much about who they are, but also how they're feeling about each other.
I really like some of the dialogue in this movie. Like, because it's so straight to the point and it kind of drives right in. There's like a moment where Heloise talks about being like, basically she was in like a nunnery or a
yes.
monastery before coming back home, and basically mentioning like she really liked being a part of the convent because it was more freedom for her there. Like there was a possibility of education. There was music, even though it was religious music, it was still music. She didn't get to ever like appreciate that like on her own before. But there was like a moment there's like moments where they, when they're talking to each other too, that they have heated discussions.
Yes.
Like, they're not always amicable with each other.
No.
At times they're kind of like at each other, but like the way they're talking to each other is like teachable moments. Like, hey, don't forget like that your life can be bigger than this. Like,
yeah.
It can go beyond structures that you've learned.
And there's a wonderful, I mean, there's a wonderful exchange they have on quite early on in the film, simply about the prospect of what she's facing. You know, we know the character of Heloise is being set to marry someone, and that's why this painting is being commissioned, so that the prospective husband can basically get a sense in those times of what she looks like.
What she look like, bro?
But there's a great sort of exchange they have on an early scene on the beach, where she asks, where Heloise asks Marianne, you know, what she knows about the man she's set to marry. And she essentially says, you know, I know he's very wealthy. I know he lives in Italy. And then she says in exchange, that's all I know either. And then she's like, so do you understand? Like, it's kind of like this moment where you understand why she's so frightened, why she's so resistant to this idea. And it's a beautifully communicated bit of dialogue, both in terms of, you know, the subtext of this the film and the sort of feminist message for it, but also just in making sense of her character and who she is as a person. I think what's also super refreshing about this movie is I've seen a lot of LGBT love stories, but for as many sort of costume drama or period dramas I've seen, I don't recall seeing one about LGBT characters. And it's kind of, there's something kind of special about a genre that has been so well trodden, and it has been a vehicle for kind of longing and romance for so long, in fiction, finally get a story that is for, you know, LGBT community, and to see that kind of representation, but also as an LGBT love story for a genre that so often, you know, and this isn't, as you said, this isn't necessarily a happy-go-lucky story. There's a lot of sadness here, but it's not miserabilia. This isn't something that revels in misery.
Yeah, there's bittersweetness. There's allusions to like the way things are going to end. But those are all based on like as much of a choice as they have.
Exactly. Which is why I think it's so powerful and why it's such a great love story is because of, at the end of the day, this is a movie more than anything, not about how things are going to end, but how things are in the moment. And that those seconds and minutes and hours you have, you know, until this might end and the company you enjoy with each other. In a weird way, actually, what this movie reminds me a lot of is Lost in Translation, in the sense that those are two movies, essentially, of two people being thrown together in a place they wouldn't expect, finding a bond, and knowing that the prospective time they have together is sort of slowly ticking away, and they're not going to be able to probably enjoy this forever, but they're cherishing that time they do have together before it ends. And it's just, it's beautiful in terms of the performances. As I said, the cinematography is insane. And I think there's something we probably, can safely agree on here, even though we can't get too in depth on it. But let's just say the ending and the final scene of this movie rules. Just fucking rules.
I cried.
Like, in terms of just an expertly done, just masterful, like, punctuation on your film, like, a true mark of like, just masterpiece. Just, I have no other words for it. It's so beautiful. The last, like, 5 minutes of this movie are so beautifully done. And the final shot of this is so genius, that it, like, it's hard not to be, it's so emotionally powerful, but it's also, as somebody who just loves the medium of film, it's so just like rousing to see how somebody uses it. Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts on this movie, bro?
Well, yeah, I mean, I loved this movie. I thought it was very wonderful. I wish I had seen it sooner. That's one of my few complaints.
Yeah.
My personally not being able to see it sooner. I will say that there are some musical moments in this film that are really fun.
Yeah.
Like, there's a moment where, like, you know, I think it's a harpsichord. I'm not really sure what the actual instrument is, but, like, the painter pulls this, she doesn't actually pull the whole covering off of it, but she just starts playing on this harpsichord in this room that she's staying in. And Heloise is just, like, sitting across the other room because she likes music so much. And she just starts playing this song and explaining what all the structures of the song is. But she can't play this song very well. She's, like, also trying to remember it. And it's, like, really cute, and
it's very endearing.
It's like, it's definitely like one of those things, like somebody pulls out a guitar and plays like a song like at a party.
Yeah,
like it feels like that, but it's a little bit, it's a lot more intimate than that. There's also a what feels like a, do you know who Stephen Reich is?
Not offhand.
Okay, so he does a lot of like clapping compositions and stuff. There's a scene where, like, in the trailer, it's where the fire shows up and her dress catches on fire. But there's all these women like kind of like doing these repetitive like cadences and then clapping. And I was like, is this like, it's like a Steve Reich thing? It's like, it's pretty cool.
Yeah,
it's very fun to watch, and it's like very tribal, and it's very, and it just kind of feels like primal in that sense. And then you just kind of have, you know, her walking away from the fire and her dress is on fire, but they're still doing the clapping.
There's something about the ambiance that it creates in that moment.
It creates an energy that's just like, it like brings the energy out in you as an audience participant.
I mean, we talk about the kind of romantic and sexual tension in this movie, and it's insane that something like that, like the scene we describe, it's simply, there's no dialogue communicated. It's pretty much only glances.
It's eye contact. It's like other people in the background creating like energy with music.
And it's somehow like this like super just intoxicating sort of atmosphere. I really, really love this movie. I think seeing it a second time, I liked it even more. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's because the first time I saw it, it was on kind of like a DVD screener. So being able to see this, you know, fully projected on the big screen with how incredible the colors and sound are in this film. The sound is something that really gripped me on the rewatch in the theater because, you know, the music, and as you mentioned in this movie, it's spare. There's not a lot of it. But when you get it, it's so powerful and overstimulating and intoxicating. This movie fucking rules. I love it.
Yeah, there's, I want to mention one more thing before kind of closing this off. There's an image that gets repeated throughout the film of Heloise like wearing a white dress but like shrouded in darkness.
Yeah.
And but like it's not really her. Like, it's just kind of, like, imposed in, like, this room, and then she'll disappear. And it just repeats over and over again. And the way that was used and the way it shows up is just kind of, like, what? Like, you're confused at first. Like, what is this?
Yeah, it's almost eerie.
Yeah, it's creepy. It's, like, kind of scary.
It has a ghost-like quality to it.
It's, like, it's a little scary because you're, like, what does this mean? And then as the movie goes on, it starts to develop a meaning.
Yeah.
And
when you find... And when, again... The like last 10-15 minutes of this movie are just knock your fucking socks off.
Yeah.
So
I highly recommend this movie.
Super highly recommend it. I think we both love this movie.
Yeah, you don't have to read the dialogue at all. You can just watch it.
If this is, I know this isn't playing everywhere, but if you are in the Buffalo area here where we are, it is playing at the Eastern Hills Cinema. It's going to be playing in limited release, so pretty much everywhere. I think I know it's definitely out in the UK as well now, too, so if you're in that market, go see it. You want to see this one on the big screen if you can.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. Brian highly recommends it. What are we going to be talking about next week, Brian?
Oh, man. Next week?
It's a big one.
Are we going to be talking about... Never, rarely, sometimes, always.
We are. So next week's a big episode for us. Mm-hmm. We're doing a special on South by Southwest.
Or Sundance?
Yes. Fuck it.
We're going to do a special on Sundance. Sundance Film Festival. And one of the biggest films that was showing there was Never Rarely, Sometimes Always. It's been showing up in a lot of other festivals and a lot of other places in a big way. And it's starring somebody from the Buffalo area.
Yeah, so we're going... So, as I mentioned, the film that premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, I believe it's currently on Metacritic the highest reviewed film of 2020 so far.
Holy shit.
And it is starring Buffalo native Sydney Flanagan. Mm-hmm. And we are going to be back next week with a review of it. We're going to be sitting down with an interview with the star of it, Sydney Flanagan. Mm-hmm. And continuing the Sundance theme, we'll be talking to a good friend of ours.
Yep. She's a director, she's a producer, she's a photographer, she does it all, Shauna Presto.
And we'll be back with all that and more next week on Cynicism. Until then, we'll see you at the movies.
I'm going to go paint a painting of Nick right now.